the House Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. Today, February 11, 2004. Clerk, take the roll, please.
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland. Anderson.
Here.
Blaine.
Yep.
Ellison.
Here.
Fuller. Bilstrom.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Lesh.
Here.
Lippman. Meslow. Murphy.
Here.
Hamar. Powell. Rhodes. Soderstrom.
Here.
Strand.
Here.
Tao.
Here.
Walls.
Here.
There is a presence of a quorum, so we will go to item 3 on the agenda, consideration of the minutes from February 10, 2004. They're in the packet. Representative Blaine moves approval. Are there any questions or additions or deletions? If not, on that motion, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have one item on our agenda today, and that should be an overview of the Department of Corrections bonding requests. And we have with us today, at least listed on the agenda, good morning, Commissioner Fabian of the Department of Corrections. Also, Deputy Commissioner Dennis Benson. Madam Commissioner, proceed. We'll try to get you through your presentation. If there are any burning questions along the way, we have the whole morning scheduled for you, so we'll try to be loose with questions along the way, but I would like to try to get through your presentation before we go to questions, if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members obviously are going to be presenting our bonding request today, and we feel that especially the Faribault project, which we'll be giving you in detail, is just essential that project be approved, and we'll be filling you in on the reasons why. If you go to the first slide, I think some of you have seen this before, but I think it's really important to bring it to your attention. We had heard a lot about Wisconsin having lower costs in many areas, but in the area of corrections, they can't compare. And in this slide, you see that we have a very similar state population. And what we spend for corrections out of the general fund is $374 million versus $825 million in Wisconsin. The total budget you see there, it's almost double. But I think it's real interesting to look at the number of inmates that are incarcerated in prison in Wisconsin. 21,000 compared to Minnesota. Actually, our new number is about 7,600. The state facilities, they have 32 versus our 8. And the per diem, even though they have that many more people, I think all the work that has been done on the per diem reduction is certainly showing here. But I think if you look at the total correctional spending, that includes what the counties spend as well, and as you all know, with the very active community corrections operations in this state, that we added that spending, and even with the county and state spending, we are still the 37th lowest per capita in spending, with $120 per person versus Wisconsin, that is the 13th highest with $192 per person. But I think when we're talking about prisons, and you look at the final part of this chart, that state correctional spending, we are the lowest in the nation. We're tied with, I think it's Maine, at $59 per person versus Wisconsin that spends $139 per person. I think it's real significant that our crime rate is lower as a result. So I think it shows that what the legislature has done in the past in funding the prisons that we have and in funding community corrections, although I think there should be more funding for community corrections, that we really have a very cost-effective system the way we have. In fact, and I just want to say one thing before we go to the next one, I came into this system not being part of the prison system, and I've known from being in corrections as long as I have that Minnesota prison system is a model for many in the nation. We get calls every day from other parts of the country trying to find out how we do it the way we do. So I think it's a real tribute to Mr. Benson and the correctional staff and our correctional officers with what's been done now. So we just want to keep the system as good as it is, and we're going to present what we need to do here. In the second slide, again, what's causing our need for more beds is the new court admissions to prison. This would include it's violations too, right? Yeah, this includes not only the it's just the new admissions, and there's been a 34% increase in new admissions since 2000. The other next slide looks at the prison population projections, and as you can see, it has been steadily increasing, and much of that I think we've talked about is due to changes in sentencing, the growth in the population in Minnesota. We definitely have prosecutors that are very aggressive in prosecuting these cases. We also have new technology like DNA that is solving a lot more problems. So all of those issues put together have certainly contributed to the increase in numbers. Now I think Dennis Benson will go on with the rest.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dennis Benson. I'm a deputy commissioner with the department. Excuse me. This first slide talks about our per diems, or reflects what has occurred with our per diems over the years. And we have placed some emphasis on trying to get our costs down. We've done some things to make our agency more efficient, and certainly we're also benefiting from the economy of scale. I think we've finally got ourselves out of the top five or six in the nation in terms of daily costs. But as the commissioner said, I think the more relevant figure is what the taxpayers pay per taxpayer on their correction system. And in Minnesota, they get a very good deal. You've all seen this next slide before, but I'm just going to kind of recap our classification system, because it really kind of leads into why we're asking for the expansion at Faribault. We have a five-level classification system now, with maximum being the most secure, and we have one facility there, Oak Park Heights. Level four, we now have three facilities, Rush City, which is full at about 1,015, I believe. Was designed for double bunking and is all double bunked except the segregation unit. St. Cloud and Stillwater are two of the older high security institutions, and we just started recently double bunking at St. Cloud. We have about 88 rooms double bunked there as we speak, and about six or seven at Stillwater. So we are beginning to double bunk at those two facilities. We're very concerned about that, and we'll watch that very closely and report any difficulties to legislative leadership that we see. We have three medium security institutions, Lionel, Moose Lake, and Faribault, about 1,100 in each of those facilities. We've got about 80% double bunk. We've double bunked everything at those facilities that we possibly can. And Faribault, of course, is the institution that we're recommending we expand, and we're recommending at medium custody because we actually have offenders at the level four institutions who are classified level three or medium that can't get there because we don't have bed space. And then we have level two minimum at Faribault, and then four level one minimum units at Stillwater, Lionel, and Faribault. Just to recap the governor's recommendations, the bonding projects included, and we'll go through these in some detail. The $74.9 million, as the commissioner said, is our highest priority. It's a must-have for this agency, given what's occurred with our intake. It does a variety of things for the department. It increases our capacity, certainly makes that facility more secure. It makes it much more efficient. We'll be doubling the size and only adding 166 staff positions, and we'll be significantly reducing the asset preservation needs. The next item in the governor's budget is the asset preservation. As you know or can imagine, in a department our size, we have windows, roofs, asbestos, plumbing needs, sewer needs, well needs, a variety of different needs. I think our, if we were to fix everything, our asset preservation bill would be many hundreds of thousands of dollars. The next item is the 150 bed segregation unit at Stillwater. This adds 150 beds to our system for the $19.2 million, and finally would give the Stillwater facility a segregation unit that is consistent with what the industry uses now to manage a segregation population. And segregation is kind of the jail within a jail. If somebody has a problem in prison, they actually are sentenced to 5 days, 10 days, 30 days in our segregation unit. They do that time and then go back to general population. The last item is $350,000, which would expand the challenge incarceration program up at the Willow River facility by 24 beds. There's a waiting list of about a year now up there. This would help with that waiting list. And those lower level offenders, we could move through the system a little bit quicker. So we're certainly supportive of that project and all of these projects.
Deputy Commissioner, the adding 24 beds would knock how much of that year wait off? How much of the 1 year wait would be knocked off by adding 24 beds?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that information, but I can certainly get that. I think once we got into it, we could probably get it down to 2 or 3 months with that kind of addition.
Okay,
but
thank
we
you.
We can do a more thorough analysis.
Go ahead.
The Faribault expansion, again, what this does for us, you've heard me say many times, we can't lock the doors in that facility. That's our driving concern at the Faribault facility right now. It was designed to be a state hospital, not a medium security prison. There are many nooks and crannies for those of you that have visited. We don't have good coverage down there. It's an inefficient facility. You've also heard me say many times that at Stillwater at the midnight watch, 18 staff run a 1,300 bed facility. At Faribault with 200 or 150 fewer inmates, it takes about 35 staff on that same watch. So there are operational efficiencies that would be addressed with this expansion. Double bunking opportunities, everybody would be in a room that locks with a toilet. We'd have wet rooms. That's one of the reasons we can't lock the existing facility, along with the fire codes. And the asset preservation, we have about $70 million worth of asset preservation down at Faribault. If we do nothing down there, the state is going to have to spend $70 million over the course of the next 15 to 20 years to address those asset preservation shortcomings. We knock about $30 million off of that with this expansion. It draws certainly from the workforce in surrounding areas. It's an easy place to recruit. We've had good luck there. It's within close enough to the metro that we can hire the not only the correctional officers, they're able to transfer from other institutions, but nurses, technicians, and other support staff. Again, it adds 1,060 beds while only adding 40% more staff. It reduces the per diem at that facility by a minimum of 10. We think it's going to be closer to $13 a day. That's a dramatic reduction in our daily costs that results in an annual savings of about $11.5 million. And this has a dramatic impact also on the departmental per diem. It reduces it quite dramatically. This next slide is...
Deputy Commissioner, at that on that point of the per diem reduction by $10 to $13, at that facility then, what would be the resulting per diem dollar amount?
Mr. Chair, why don't you give us about 5 minutes?
That's fine. That's fine. Go ahead.
This next slide is a picture of what the facility looks like today. We have about 20 buildings, those that are in the lighter shade. The darker green are all buildings that would stay. They've been renovated either with the 1988-89 remodeling or since we converted from a treatment center. And the lighter shaded buildings would be demolished through phase one and phase two of our construction. We'll jump to the next slide, which shows you how this facility would be cleaned up. And I want to emphasize the fact that this will be all but a brand new correctional facility when it's completed. If you notice the buildings that are shaped like the letter K, we refer to those as K buildings. They each hold 416 offenders, 208 rooms that are double bunked. And we have one of these that we're currently constructing at Lionel Lakes. And it's dramatic, the sight lines, visibility. They're very, very efficient. They're state-of-the-art design for medium custody. And I would certainly invite the committee to take a look if you've got the time. We could bus you out there and bus you back in an hour and a half, take you right to the building. It is a dramatic improvement over what we're trying to deal with at our medium custody institutions now. Phase one would include the three on the bottom of the page here. We would build 3K buildings, and we would eliminate many buildings that are slated for demolition. We would also do some remodeling of existing buildings down there. So we just think that given all the givens, given what our needs are in terms of enhancing safety down there, improving program opportunities down there, diminishing the asset preservation bill at the Faribault facility, and reducing the cost, doing this very efficiently, we think this plan makes the most sense. In a moment, we'll go over some of the other options that we have explored, and you'll get a feel for, I hope, that we have done our homework here. We're also going to compare this expansion with privatization, with going out and building a new facility, and I think that the numbers will show you that I don't think anybody can do it cheaper than what we're proposing here today. This building is just a footprint of what those K buildings look like.
Deputy Commissioner, excuse me, we will keep questions during this presentation to a minimum unless it seems to be on point. Representative Rhodes.
This is, I think, on point, but I'll
go ahead.
At it. Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, you also house like the nursing home type of facility down in Faribault, I believe. Is that, I didn't see that as part of this, but I would think your population is aging, and as we have more life sentences, is that also slated for change? I didn't notice it on the slide.
Deputy Commissioner Benson.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Sir.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rhodes, yes, that population is certainly increasing every year. We are adding some, expanding the healthcare facilities down there, which is attached to that unit. We do have adequate beds right now, and we're also, when we can identify somebody that doesn't need to be in prison, who's aging and they're incapacitated, we have a status called conditional medical release where we can release them into the community, get them under MA and get them off of our payroll. And we do that as often as we can. So the combination of that plus some minor expansion of the, I believe it's the Linden building down there that houses the geriatric population and also the infirm, the paraplegics, quadriplegics, we have a couple of those as well. We're okay for the foreseeable future, but we are looking at partnership in the community with a nursing home as well, exploring the feasibility of that. So yes, that was very much a part of the planning that went into this as well. again, this K building being designed or being built at Lionel, exact same footprint as what we're proposing for Faribault. Phase one, which is the 74.9, would build three of these, and phase two would build the final two. These housing units, again, double bunk, wet rooms, lockable, excellent camera coverage, designed for superior observation, fenced in yards so we can fence the buildings off from one another to continue with our controlled movement concept, which has served the agency very well over the years. And we would also decrease our minimum security population from 136 to 75 down there. 75 is about the number we need to keep the grounds and groomed well, the sidewalk shoveled, and running our laundry down there, which is also located outside of the wall. This chart, this slide just simply shows you what the capacity is at the end of phase one and phase two. Phase one adds 701 beds, and then phase two would add the additional 359 beds to the Faribault facility. And of course, phase two, our intention would be to come back 2 years from now and ask for bonding dollars for that, and that's about $34.5 million, I believe. We've kind of gone through the operational efficiencies, but again, replacing the inefficient housing units, improving surveillance, the infrastructure. We've talked a lot about the tunnel system down there, the sewer water and wastewater tunnel. We put millions of dollars into that already, and that piece of the infrastructure is in good repair. On the other hand, as you can see from this slide, the utility tunnels are in abhorrent condition here. The one on the right indicates where a front-end loader actually penetrated the tunnel, went through the tunnel, could have resulted in a very serious injury to a staff. Fortunately, it didn't. We've been cited by OSHA in terms of going into those tunnels, so we don't make the kind of security checks that we ought to in a prison simply because they are so unsafe. There are asbestos issues down there from time to time as the pipes shift. We have asbestos problems that we're continuously addressing. And all of the electrical conduit that you can see in the slide to the left, according to codes people and OSHA, has to be replaced. It has to be replaced with waterproof conduit that would address the shortcomings down there. So this project actually will bury all of the utility tunnels and will go to direct burial to the new buildings. Another issue that we're concerned about with our population, if you add beds, you've
Deputy
got
Commissioner, I have a question. I'm trying to find out without interrupting the previous slide showing a couple of items. What's the original construction date of those of that stuff that we're looking at in those photographs? When was it built?
Mr. Chair, I think it's been continuous probably since about the turn of the century. Some of these buildings were built in the 1800s, many of them in the early 1900s. So the span of time, the old wastewater tunnel, which was actually it's actually a sandstone tunnel, would probably be closer to the turn of the century. But we're talking 60, 70, 80 years for many of these tunnels. I can get you exact dates at a later time, but that's the best information I can give you today.
And the asset preservation at $11 million that you're also seeking, I heard you use the phrase it would make that all but new.
If we went ahead with the expansion, the tunnels would no longer be an issue because we would bury them and we would do direct burial to the different units. We wouldn't have tunnels anymore. So it actually addresses a glaring security issue as well and safety issue for our staff. We would no longer have the utility tunnel. We just have the wastewater tunnel.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt. Go on with that next slide then.
As we said, we're adding 1,000 beds. We also have to add program. Program in our system is key. It's the one thing, as the commissioner said, that I think sets our system aside from many other systems in the nation. We're able to employ, even in today's economy, we have about 14 or 15% of our inmate population who want to be involved in programming are involved in programming, whether that be industry, chemical dependency, sex offender, educational, vocational training. We try to provide those program options. As you know, the MNCOR program 5 years ago was asked to break even, and this year they did that. We have about 1,000 offenders employed, and we're excited about the future. We can add jobs without asking the taxpayers for additional dollars, and the MNCOR program does that very efficiently. We're involved in many public-private partnerships. An example is the Mylar Balloon Factory down at Faribault. We employ about 100 inmates, and we package the big party balloons that you've all seen and send them all over the planet. We also do the laundry in the upper left. That slide talks about the, or underscores the laundry program. We do all of the sheets, towels, and pillowcases for our agency, many nursing homes, hospitals. The slide to the upper right is an injection mold machine. We just sold $250,000 worth of foot lockers to the Missouri Department of Corrections. So we're actually partnering with other departments of corrections around the nation as well. Lower left would underscore our partnership with DOT, Department of Transportation. We paint their trucks, we hang plows on the trucks, puts inmates to work, teaches them a transferable skill as well. And then of course our wood shop down there on the bottom right. Again, to summarize, phase one, $74.9 million, constructs three of the 416-bed units, and it centralizes food service. One of the shortcomings of Faribault is the fact that we have three different food service areas, and it takes literally hours to feed a meal. As we piecemeal this institution together, and we created three different kitchens. This way, we would centralize under one roof. That would be part of phase one expansion and feed our population much more efficiently. Could hopefully get a longer program day once we do that. It would also expand our health services building, as I mentioned. More activities and educational buildings would be available. Would renovate minimum custody, demolish all the unused buildings that are really a drain on asset preservation dollars that have been appropriated. It would renovate the power plant and understand that the power plant also feeds the Society for the Blind down in Faribault. It's high pressure steam and make it much more efficient and save the taxpayers some dollars as well. Phase two, $34.8 million. Again, we construct the last two 416-bed units, remodel the remaining unused or program buildings, and demolish the remaining unused buildings. And again, that would be a 2006-2008. This next slide is our best shot at trying to compare Faribault expansion with contracting. And our base per diem at Faribault, we believe by adding 166 staff, adding the equipment costs, the current expense costs, which would be consumables, toilet paper, food, all of those other things, is included in that $29.83. Contracting, we've been quoted as recently as late this summer. We visited Prairie Correctional Facility, and I would remind you that the last time we rented from them was in the late 90s. We paid $55 a day. They're quoting us, well, $55 to $60. I can't help but believe that inflation hasn't driven it at least to $60 a day. In addition to that, health care costs have to be included because our experience with our vendor has been that they will not take inmates who have medical, ongoing medical issues. And if they do get one, if they have to take a trip to the hospital, they bill back the department. So we have added that $6.71 to both our side of the ledger and contracting because that's the ongoing medical costs for every new inmate coming into the facility that we pay our private vendor. Just, I'm going to quote you a couple of things that was in the last contract with Prairie here. They will take those requiring services of a surgeon. This is what we pay for, the state. Those requiring services of an oral surgeon, those requiring acquisition of special limited use equipment, all medical services, supplies, pharmaceutical provided to inmates who have tested positive for HIV or affected with AIDS, all medical services, supplies, and pharmaceuticals provided to inmates who suffer from a chronic illness defined as recurring diseases, ailments, or habits which are perpetual, like asthma, and or constant nature and which are expected to last for a long period of time. So the bottom line is they don't cover much in terms of health care, so we have to add that to the cost. That was our experience when we contracted back in the 90s. We also have inmate support costs that we add to both sides of the ledger that are central office costs, departmental costs, that include things like transportation. We have to provide transportation, special investigations. If we are involved with law enforcement, we will continue to have to cover that. Those that are released, our fugitive unit, hearings officers for those that are approaching release, they still have to put together a release plan that's approved by us, and our section of hearings and release would hear those release plans, our records unit, legal services, and certainly all litigation, and there's a fair amount of that. If you talk to states who have contracted, they'll tell you that the state is not off the hook when they contract. Contract facility monitoring, we'll have a couple of monitors and certainly casework staff that have to continue to work. Information and technology, human resources, those costs are all included in that $4.50 for both Faribault and contracting. And then on the Faribault side, we've even included debt service, $19.48 a day. That's what it's going to take to pay off the bond. So the marginal per diem for the Faribault expansion, including all of those costs, is $60.52. Contracting, it's going to be around $70. We think it's going to be higher than that. So the yearly costs, it starts out at $23.4 million as compared to $27.6. And I think the real hinge pin here is understand that when we're all done, we have a facility. We have an investment for our dollar. Contracting is a little bit like leasing a car. You get done with the lease period and you've got nothing. So we have an investment in the future here. For the state of Minnesota, this facility will be prepared to serve the state for the better part, we think, of the next 100 years, as many of our facilities have. And the other thing is the staff safety issue. I can't emphasize enough the issue of staff safety in that institution. And I'm just going to digress for a quick moment and talk to those of you that haven't heard the story about what happened at Lionel Lakes here about 4 years ago, a similarly constructed institution where we can't lock the doors at night. In the middle of the night, we had a female officer working a living unit, and an inmate offender, a sex offender, snuck up behind her, hit her on the head with a radio, drug her down two flights of stairs. We watched this on videotape, and took her into a corner, and we won't say any more about what occurred there, but you can only imagine. But when she came back on tape, he had a razor blade to her throat, marched her to the front gates of the Lionel Lakes facility and demanded a car. And that's one example, probably a pretty provocative example, of what can happen in a facility that you can't lock at night that wasn't designed to be a correctional facility. And this expansion will address those needs. If we go another direction, if we go to privatization, or we do something different with responding to this population problem, Lino, and we've addressed with the 1K building, but Faribault will continue to be a facility that is, in my mind, not suited to house the kind of offender that's coming into our facility today, and it really does need to be addressed.
If you could hold for a moment, I'd like to introduce some students to the committee that we have here today. They're students from the Holy Trinity School from South St. Paul. Welcome. And just to let you students know what we're doing here today, this is the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. We're kind of doing our homework today. We're at our table giving us some testimony and telling us about one of our prison facilities in Faribault. You will see the lady is the commissioner of the Department of Corrections, Joan Fabian, and with her testifying is the deputy commissioner, Dennis Benson, and we're hearing testimony on the proposal that the governor's made for expansion at Faribault. And with that, let's get back to it. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I would add that dangerous situation at Lionel Lakes was resolved without anyone being harmed. But again, it's teaching us a lesson. And it was on the heels of that we asked for some bonding dollars, and we used some federal dollars to build the 1K building at Lionel Lakes. Getting back to the question regarding per diem, our current per diem at Faribault is $66 a day. That includes medical, that's everything, mental health. After phase one, it would drop it to $55 per day. After phase two, it would drop it to $52 a day. So it's a pretty dramatic drop in per diem and makes it a safer facility, a more program-rich facility, and reduces the asset preservation needs at that facility and meets our growth needs, at least for the next few years anyway. I'm going to quickly go over this slide. This slide just kind of, again, summarizes what would happen after 10 years and understand that there's no inflation included in these numbers. We're going to attempt to do a chart that includes inflation so you can see what would happen after 10 years with inflation, because we believe the savings would probably be even greater comparing privatization with the Faribault expansion after 10 years if we included inflation. Inflation would be relatively the same on either side of the ledger. I don't know how any private company could prevent that. And in those cases where they have lowballed a contract, and that's something that happens frequently in the contracting business, and the commissioner will give you an example here in a moment of what a very personal one of what happened to Ramsey County. But we've been doing our research on privatization too, and there's a situation brewing right now in the state of Nevada where Corrections Corporation of America entered into a contract with Nevada to run the female facility out there, and they obviously underbid it, and now they're putting the state on notice, state of Nevada, either you assume the medical costs or we're going to have to abandon the contract. So that's one example of what happens with privatization and coming in with a low ball number. And the commissioner can talk about what happened with female offenders in Ramsey County.
And I, Mr. Chair, I may have given this already, but when we used to in Ramsey County, they used to house the women in Hennepin County, but as we got more offenders, women offenders, there wasn't room in Hennepin. So we did a contract with Volunteers of America, and so we would pay a per diem. It started out at $59 a day, and within 9 years, it was $106 a day. So I think, we had no control over it. We then had dismantled anything that we had in place prior to that, and then, we had to pay I guess it was $105, I shouldn't exaggerate, but we had to keep paying that because there was no other place to put them. So I that's the one thing, one of the reasons that I think it's real, you need to be careful in looking at the privatization.
Mr. Chair and members, this next slide compares, if we would go out, we were asked by the bonding chair in the House to do an analysis of Faribault compared to a new facility if we went out in the middle of a cornfield somewhere in Minnesota and started from scratch. And this slide does a comparative analysis of all three options: Faribault expansion, contracting, and a brand new facility. Construction costs, of course, at Faribault are almost $110 million. Contracting would charge us nothing for the construction, but they do build it into their per diem. The new facility would cost us, our best estimate is about $200 to $225 million. We've asked an architect to do an analysis, and this is what they came up with. This isn't our number. The per diem then, for all of the beds, Faribault would be $65.95, contracting would be $71.21, and the new facility would be $74.69. Yearly costs, $55, $59, and $62 million. And again, over a 10-year period, the Faribault expansion option would save $44 million versus $73 million for a new facility. Again, understand that this does not include inflation. We just based it on today's dollars. Our thinking was that inflation, whatever it might be, would remain constant for all three options. So as we looked at this, we do feel confident that we not only have the option that works the best for the agency, but it also works the best for the taxpayers, and it makes the most sense for the state of Minnesota at this time. This slide just goes into more detail of what is built into those costs, the base per diems, the health care costs. You're going to include all the costs at Faribault would be $11. Contracting, we just added the $6.71. In the new facility, we added all the costs as well. And inmate support would remain constant, and the death service would be included on the Faribault, and the new facility, of course, over 2,200 beds would be $1,777. And we amortize that over 30 years. So obviously there are fiscal folks in the room. We've got our fiscal people here. We would invite anybody to call us and engage in some dialogue around these numbers. We don't think we've padded anything. We don't think we've misrepresented the facts. We know them or have experienced them today, and would be happy to have more conversation about these options. In summary, total cost 109.7, phase one 74.9, phase two 34.8. Again, it improves staff and inmate safety, public safety, doubles the size, reduces asset preservation by $30 million, long-term savings over renting beds, and you have a product at the end of that period in time. Projections show future need for beds, obviously they are coming. We're going to need the dollars. And the low operating cost, the marginal per diem for just these beds at Faribault is $40 to $45 a day, which is, I think, very competitive with any other option out there. Now, obviously, it does take $74 million off the table for bonding projects out there. We believe firmly that prisons, operating prisons to the extent that we can, needs to be a function of government. It needs to be a responsibility that remains with government. Privatization, from my perspective, I think if we go back 50, 60, 70 years, if we would have privatized the mental health facilities around this state, I don't know that we would have ever been able to close them down and move the people back into the mainstream to the extent that we have been able to. But we've had some experience with the private prison companies that have caused us some concern, just in terms of the voidus dollars that used to come into the state. Those are dollars that we could use to build prison beds, but the privateers were able to get a piece of legislation included at the federal level that those dollars could be used for renting private prison beds as well. So if you don't think there's a strong lobby out there that's going to keep this alive, I would beg to differ, because I really do believe that when you're making money, you can't afford to do probably the right thing with sentencing policy someday, and certainly with the dollars that might come from the federal government. Very personally, and I'm not representing the department, I have a real moral issue with locking people up for profit on a large-scale basis. We believe in some privatization around the fringes. We privatized our medical contract. We privatized food service. We do have private contracts for information and technology. Much of our maintenance we do with private contracts now because we don't need to have staff on board. But privatizing an entire segment of our prison operation, I just think that that's the wrong direction to go. So you've heard that speech more than once or twice before. But if you've got questions about that, there are all kinds of alarming stories out there with the private prison projects. If you talk to New Mexico, the former governor, I believe Gary Johnson, in 1999 kicked both Wackenhut and CCA out of New Mexico because of major problems in that state. Major problem in the Youngstown, Ohio facility that was a CCA facility that finally had to close after stabbings and murders and escapes. The community was up in arms. There's a very interesting legislative report from Ohio that you might be interested in getting a look at. And I have to say that our last visit to Prairie, it looked pretty good. We were impressed with what we saw out there in terms of a good administrative team, some programming out there. The place looked pretty good to us. But in previous visits, it didn't look so good. And I guess my concern is, will it stay good, or might it go back to the way that it was in terms of the way that it was managed? And understand, when a private company comes into a state, they have to hire just about all new staff. They may get some staff to transfer, but hiring very junior staff for a new correctional facility, hundreds of them, is very dangerous. You've got to have experienced staff. If we expand, we bring staff, experienced staff from all over the agency, and we add the more inexperienced staff to 10 institutions as opposed to bringing them all to one. So that's the difference. And even when we opened Rush City, we had growing pains and problems. So that's the problem that private companies have. Their turnover rates, by their own admission, is over 25% to 30%. And in the prison business, that can happen, or you got trouble. That's what we had in Stillwater back in 1974, 5, and 6, and that's when we had murders, mayhem, and prison disturbances to a great degree. Other options that we looked at, we did look at Stillwater and St. Cloud. Stillwater, there's really no meaningful space to expand. St. Cloud, probably one unit inside, but they do have land across the road that we could build a facility at if we chose to someday. But we really didn't need the beds at that higher custody level. And that's why we also chose not to go to Rush City this time, where we can add two pods, but we really need the space at medium custody. Lino is kind of landlocked. There's no place to expand there. Moose Lake, we could possibly expand one or two units someday at Moose Lake, but Faribault has a larger land mass, and we could add greater numbers there than Moose Lake. Camp Ripley, of course, has some opportunity, but it would only be for minimum custody, and we need medium. Regional treatment centers, we really want to add to existing physical plants to the extent that we can. We think we can save everybody some dollars and expand at existing places. The way of the industry is to build complexes. You've heard me say Arizona has 6 prisons inside of one fence. Colorado has 8 or 10 prisons in one probably 10 square mile area. And then again, you can save all those infrastructure costs like the warden, the finance department, and on and on and on. We looked at out-of-state options, Wisconsin, but they have no room, of course. Privatization, you've just heard our spiel on why we don't think that makes good sense. We're going to move quickly through the other initiatives. We don't have a lot to say about them. The asset preservation, $11 million is in the governor's budget. We need all of that and many millions more, but this is a good start. Would do things like window replacement. You've all seen the nice windows at Stillwater from 1910. They're great collector's items, but on a day like this, they don't do much to keep the weather out. Tuck pointing, we have lots of brick in our agency, lots of tuck pointing needs, lots of asbestos issues in the agency, emergency lighting, roof repairs, again, sewers, wastewater, drainage systems have to be repaired. So that would be where we would put the $11 million that has been earmarked for asset preservation. Again, a couple of pictures that show, underscore some tuck pointing needs around the agency. Roof repairs. One thing that I think the state got into were the flat roofs, and we're the Oak Park Heights roof, for example, which is 23 years old, we're replacing that because the day we opened that facility, it started to leak, and we have been patching it for years, and now we're repairing it with an upgraded roof. So that's what happens when you start to go cheap. These are those nice windows that I mentioned at Stillwater. The next project is the 150-bed segregation unit at Stillwater, $19.4 million. I'm going to go to the next slide here for a moment, actually two slides. What we did at Stillwater, many of you have seen it, but we actually just took a quarter of a cell block, screened in the front, which you see on the left side of your the screen here, and called it a segregation unit. That's not how you do modern-day segregation in prisons. You've got to have doors that close on the front so they can't yell back and forth, and they can't throw objects and fluids at staff. And I'll let your imagination be your guide in terms of what kinds of fluids get thrown at staff. But it's a tough situation to work in. Again, there are safety issues. When we have an inmate that's up on the top tier acting out, staff have to go up and move them down. People get injured. We have workers' comp claims from that unit. And the new segregation would be just a two-tier with a single flight of stairs. Closed fronts, much more consistent with what the industry standard has become for prison segregation units. So the proposed remodeling then would just be to return the, we build the new unit, and I'll get to that in a moment, but the old unit we'd return to part of that cell block and just make it a continuation of the front half of that block so we could add these, we take the segregation staff that we currently have, move them into the new building, and use the existing staff to staff the back half of the unit, so we could add this unit without adding a lot of staff. I think we had a couple of caseworkers, a psychologist, but the uniform staff we wouldn't have to add anymore. So again, the operational efficiencies would be dramatically increased at Stillwater. We think that would reduce their per diem by $5-$6 a day, which would also impact positively on the agency. In our Stillwater facility, you can see the little pink arrow there, which indicates where the proposed segregation unit would be built. And just to the left of that probable location designation is the old health services building, which is no longer used. We did remodel part of an old laundry into our health services that was bonded. 4 years ago, I believe, and that has really worked out very, very well. So we would demo the old hospital and put the segregation unit in that spot. It improves safety and security, improves sight lines for observation. We could use the current segregation unit for a cell block again, which it was originally designed for, and we would construct it on existing facility grounds, and as I mentioned, the per diem would be lower. The last bonding initiative included in the governor's bill is the 24-bed housing unit up at the Willow River Challenge Incarceration Boot Camp, as we affectionately call it. And again, as I mentioned, it would reduce the waiting list. This is one of the very few programs we have in Minnesota that can actually expedite somebody's movement through the system. We've had excellent results with recidivism of people that move through this program. It has a strong chemical dependency component. They do lots of things around cognitive thinking and anger management. We have an educational component, and the people that complete that program and go to phase two and three, very few of them are involved in coming back to prison. And one could argue that, yeah, you take the easiest to manage piece of our population, but we are in the process of designing a research study that will give us some empirical data that hopefully will be convincing around the impact of this program. It does wonderful things for the community. They're involved in work crews, community work crews. They have an excellent relationship with the community up there. We've expanded the female piece of that programming as well. We're now doing all of the challenge incarceration programming for our females up at the Thistledew facility, and we've increased that to 24 beds, and that leaves room to expand the male portion up to over 100 beds. So we're excited about this project. It's not much money, but we think it does a lot of things in terms of addressing the needs of those lower level offenders in our system. A couple of pictures of boot camp, and again, summarizing the governor's recommendations, and with that, we... and ready to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. We will go to the questions now. Currently, we have Representatives Lippman, Murphy, and then Ellison. Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have a comment and two questions for Commissioner Fabian and her team. In the seven or so years as a staff person and then as a member that I've been working on bonding issues, I think that this package is probably the best of any agencies I've ever seen. I think Faribault, the segregation unit, replacing the windows at Stillwater, expansion of CIP, asset preservation as far as the heavy weighting, I think it's probably the very best package I've ever seen, and I think it's commendable to not only this team at Corrections, but also to the governor. I do have two questions, however. One is first about what's not on the list as far as prison elements. When Representative Murphy chaired this committee, I guess two chairmen ago, she would urge folks to bring pictures of people and things that she cared about. So I brought one of mine. Here's MCF Stillwater that you might be able to see. And I'll use Representative Wallsey. Immediately to the west is a pond, a natural spring pond that the Department of Corrections built in at the turn of the century, which produces 500,000 gallons of water a day. It used that pond for MCF Stillwater for a period of 80 or so years in 1987, and then there was a stormwater sewer pipe that went to the St. Croix. In 1987, the Department of Corrections said, well, we're not going to repair the pipe anymore. And it's been a flooding problem for my constituents here in Bayport, indeed the folks who are guards at your facility. I'm just wondering if it's not on your list, given the struggles that the pond that Corrections created is causing for my community, will you at least write a letter to legislators or to the governor saying this should be part of this year's bonding package, and if not, why not?
Deputy Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lipman, as you know, I believe about, I'd say at least three-fourths of that project has been bonded and completed. So much of the problem has been alleviated, and I understand that there's about $1 million or $1.2 million that needs to be addressed yet in terms of connecting something to something else. And I don't know all of the intricacies of this pond, certainly as well as you do. I can tell you that we were waiting. I mean, we don't quite see this, with all due respect, as a DOC responsibility. But in the past, it has certainly impacted on our bonding number. And we were waiting this past year for something to come from the local units of government out there. Nothing did. So we certainly didn't go out and pursue it, because obviously, as you can see, we had other requests that were not included as well. I think we would always be willing to work with the Bayport community with respect to this issue in terms of trying to get it resolved. However, I'm sure you also understand it would be very difficult for us at this stage of the game to go back to the Department of Finance and the governor's office and say, gee, could you include this? I mean, again, we're not turning our nose up at the need. We'd like to be part of the solution, not the problem here. But in terms of including it at this point, for us to be involved in that would be very difficult.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Benson. Just a comment on that, in the sense that the corrections created the pond and used it for 80 years, and indeed the city of Bayport came in with its own pumps at its own expense to rescue MCF Stillwater when in the 80s there was flooding problems there. They were good neighbors to the department. I think I would urge you to consider a letter being a good neighbor back. But let me go on to my next and final question. Mindful that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has just recently issued a report on drug offenders, profiling the kinds of folks who are going to our prisons, and your presentation set out plans for additional 1,400 beds worth of construction, particularly at the medium custody level. I was wondering, A, have you read the report, and B, what do you think about it?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, I have read the report, and most of us in the department have. And, I mean, I certainly think that it's worth looking at. Having come from county government, though, I know that with community corrections that many of the drug offenders that end up in prison have had, you know, many, many chances at treatment and alternatives before they came to prison. And what I didn't see in that report, and which we're trying to look into, is, you know, kind of a profile of that number of offenders, because I don't know that they shouldn't be in prison. I don't think in Minnesota that too many come to prison that shouldn't be. So we're trying to look at what category really could get out, because with plea bargains and other things, you know, a fifth degree, you know, drug case isn't necessarily a fifth degree drug case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Representative Murphy.
Go back to Ms. Benson when you were talking about privatization and the responsibility of the State Department of Corrections with health care. Did I conclude correctly that even if the whole system was privatized, we would still have to run a Department of Corrections, and the Department of Corrections would still have to maintain enough funding and expertise for health care and the things that you included in the $4.50 legal basis and so forth?
Deputy Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, if the entire system, and that's not the case in any state to date anyway, at that point, hopefully you could negotiate something a little bit differently. But the experience that we have had personally and the experience of other states who have entered into contracting has been that they're pretty picky about who they take into the facility if they have medical maladies of any sort. So based on our past experience, based on the contract language, based on what we've heard from our neighbors out there who have entered into private contracts, the health care costs become very skewed. If they get to pick the 500 that are well, we get to keep those that have all the issues. Our costs go up. Theirs, obviously, are next to nothing. So, again, in an effort to balance the ledger here, and I'm sure the privateers will take issue with our analysis, but we base it on experience. We base it on dialogue with other jurisdictions. And certainly, we all know what's going on with healthcare costs. The other thing we have to understand is if we have all of the inmates on our side of the system that have to have dialysis, that are the asthmatics, that are diabetic, they don't. That's going to change the amount that we're going to be spending compared to what they're going to be spending. So, you know, obviously just renting some beds, we're going to have all of the healthcare facilities that we do today.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Benson, they can pick and choose.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, again, that has been our experience, and that has been the experience of others. I think if you talk to our neighbors to the east who are now bringing their inmates back to Wisconsin facilities, they would, if they're willing to be honest with you, they would tell you some things about their experience with privatization as it pertains particularly with health care.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, could you talk about the liability that the state has to maintain in relation to their contract with the private prisons?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I'm not an attorney, but I've talked to a lot of attorneys on this issue. And try as you may to pass on the legal liability to the private entity, and they will all come in and say, we have millions of dollars worth of insurance. If we get sued, we handle it. The bottom line is, if the state is always on the hook. Again, that's been the experience. If you go call Youngstown, talk to them about the pending lawsuits out there, talk to New Mexico about pending litigation down there, the state is not off the hook. The private entity may very well be part and party of that litigation, but the experience of others and our legal analysis of that issue from our department, from the attorneys inside of corrections, tells us that we are still ultimately on the hook.
Mr.
Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Benson, could you talk about, you know, when we went back and Faribault was closing down as a mental health institution and a community treatment center, and they were going to close down, and we went down and heard from the community and so forth about what a wonderful community it was and that the state had committed to them, and they had this wonderful workforce, and that we should replace our commitment in human services with a commitment for Department of Corrections, and the legislature agreed to that, and the gyms were packed on all occasions. And so we were replacing one state commitment for another. You suggested that it's been suggested that we just find some other community with cornfields in it and just put a prison out there.
kind of, some of us did not embrace Appleton with wide open arms, and one of the reasons was it was so far out in the cornfields that and was being used primarily solely at that time for economic development. At that time and since, you've said that there should be some infrastructure that's already there and freeways and so forth, and that cornfields weren't so great places. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, well, you've heard me say so many times that the way of the corrections industry today is to build prisons close to one another. Prison complexes, that would be one argument not to go out and start all over in the middle of a field. If, you know, by our standards, a 2,000-bed facility is a very large facility, but by the industry standards, it's not so large. The Complex Lewis that we've all read about and heard about in the news in Arizona, where they have the hostage situation for 12 days, is the one where they actually have six prisons inside of one perimeter. So I don't think we want to continue to locate prisons all over the state. If we have existing land and infrastructure at existing physical plants that we can take advantage of, again, all of those infrastructure costs, the maintenance department is already there, the fiscal department is already there, the IT department, the warden, the healthcare unit is already there. Let's add to these facilities and maximize our infrastructure. Transportation is another huge issue. Every time you take an offender outside of the perimeter, there's a public safety issue. And to the extent that we can minimize that, we ought to. And if we start to move them from one corner of the state to another, things can happen. Things happen during transport that could jeopardize public safety. So I think that's another issue. But we also, we do have a relationship with the Faribault community. They're just down the Beltline, and it's an excellent community. We've worked very well in transitioning some of the old DHS employees, not old, but former DHS employees to corrections. That's worked out very well for us. It's almost a suburb anymore, Faribault. So we have made that commitment to the community. And even our industry program, there is a business in Faribault that actually was on the precipice of sending jobs to Mexico because they just simply couldn't keep and find and afford to keep their local factory open. So in an effort to do that, they came to us, and now we're putting together circuit boards, our inmate offenders are, as part of our industry program, which managed to keep that business alive, keep jobs in the community, and also partnering with our offenders, teaching them a transferable skill. So we have an investment in the community, and I believe the community would tell you they have an investment in us. I think there are some that were always sad and probably will be sad around the fact that the old hospital went away. People, as those of you from the Moose Lake area know, have an affection for the patients that used to occupy those facilities. But I think that we have community meetings down there with law enforcement, with the Chamber of Commerce every quarter. We have an excellent relationship. The recruitment down there is very fertile. We're able to find correctional officers. I think I've heard that 80% of the employees, at 80 or 60, live in the Faribault area. So it would be a traumatic economic issue if this facility were to move or even not expand. That area is also expanding. And it makes no sense to me to unwind what we've already done there and go somewhere else. But also, we have an obligation to those 300 to 400 staff that are down there to complete the project that was begun back in the 80s. We have to build these new units. We have to make this a safe correctional facility so that we don't have more problems like they had at Lionel Lakes. When I was a warden, and I was a warden at the two high security institutions, 10 o'clock came, everybody was locked in, I could roll over and go to bed. But the warden down there, the warden at Moose Lake, the warden at Lionel, can't lock their doors at night. So anything can happen in the middle of the night. You don't have that time to recharge the batteries and know that your staff are safe and know that the inmates are all tucked in these medium security facilities. They were all designed for Lionel initially had 200 inmates. Faribault initially had 500. And I think Moose Lake had 400 or 500 initially. And this population has driven us to the point where we have pushed that envelope to the precipice of safety or disaster, whichever way you want to look at it. And now I think we have to take pause and we have to fix some of these conditions that we have created where we're going to have problems in our system. The kind of offender that's coming in today is different than the kind of offender that came in 1974 when I started. There are people that don't care. You're reading the same newspapers I do every day, and I think you can attest to the fact that there are some precarious individuals that end up in our correctional system. We have people at medium custody that have 10 years left to serve. While they have an investment in their sentence, they have a long ways to the front door in some cases, and we can't treat them like they're minimum custody inmates, or we're going to get in trouble. So for lots of reasons, but the bottom line here is we've got to address some of those safety issues at that facility, and we can do that while reducing costs, while reducing asset preservation needs, and expanding our systems to meet our population growth. In my mind, this is such a no-brainer. I understand we need to have the debate, but compared to all the other options, this one makes so much sense to me. And we really did our homework on this project. Department of Finance, to their credit, 5 years ago told us, look, you've got to come up with a bed space plan. We've done that, and we're prepared to hand out at a future hearing our bed space plan for the future. But they said, you also have to understand what your asset preservation needs are in your department. So we went out and we hired an architect or a consulting firm to do an analysis of all three of our mediums. And we identified Faribault as the one with the biggest hole and the one with the most glaring needs. They have the land mass, the community's used to us, they have the space to expand adequately, so we picked Faribault. So we feel good about the due diligence that we did with respect to the location of this facility. And Mr. Storkamp has just handed me the analysis of all three of our medium custody facilities that really tell us what we need to do to get these facilities all in good repair as we move ahead.
Mr. Chair, just one more question.
Representative Murphy.
Commissioner Fabian, if the legislature accepts the governor's and Department of Corrections proposal, do you anticipate that Minnesota will still be 49th in per capita state corrections spending?
Commissioner Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, I do.
And that's a good number, right?
That's a really good number. You can't get much better.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Ellison, then Johnson, then Eastland. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, my question is directed to either the Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner. First of all, I wanted to ask you, how will the governor's proposal affect the budget that was approved last year? I know this is for capital bonding, and that was more or less for operational expenses, but there are some operations monies in this bonding request. So I know that you were cut about 7% last year, if memory serves. How will this affect your budget situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, that's a good question, and a question that, interestingly enough, we're getting from the Senate, too. But as most of you know, every couple times a year, Department of Finance does a budget forecast. Included in their forecasting, they always come to us and ask us what our growth forecast is, what are our population projections. So they build into their forecasting dollars, and we use that marginal per diem number that we come up with every year. This year it's around $59.79 per inmate that we're projecting. They put that into their forecast. Now, obviously, that's so we feel good about the fact that at least they're identifying that as a future obligation on the part of the state. As you know, that amount, whatever it is, still has to be debated by the legislature and determine how much we get. And obviously, the governor in his budget chooses to include it or not include it. But historically, there's always been a base adjustment for corrections growth in the governor's budget proposal since I've been down here, and that's been 8 years. So, and it happened prior to me coming as well. So there is consideration built into the budget forecasting process to identify and include some dollars for corrections growth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
I wanted to just make the observation, and I think I'm right about this, that in the recent study we saw on drug sentencing, that I think I'm correct in stating that about a third of those of the growth in drug sentence in the prison overall prison population was, or maybe a third of the increase was fifth degree controlled substance crimes. I think I'm correct about that. I'm looking across the table at Representative Lipman, hoping he knows.
Forgive me, I was thinking about another topic here.
Okay, about a third of the growth in prison sentencing is in fifth degree controlled substances. Is that?
I think that's about right. And the other point that I guess that I would make, Mr. Chairman, is that with regards to the offenders coming in, fully 40% or nearly 40% of them have a criminal history score of zero.
Well, I was going to add, Mr. Chair, if I may, that about 54% have a criminal history score of zero or one.
Right.
And so I just want to make that observation and just ask this question. If we look carefully at drug sentences, if we perhaps expanded the CIP program, would that relieve some of the bed pressure that you all are facing in the Department of Corrections without sacrificing public safety? I mean, that's sort of a big question, but I'm just interested in your viewpoint, if you care to offer one.
Deputy Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, as we've said so many times in the past, these are tough policy issues that you have to wrestle with. To the extent that we have been able to, we've kind of taken ourselves out of that loop because these are really, we think, policy questions. We can certainly give you some perspective from our perspective on the CIP program. We, as I mentioned a moment ago, we think it's been a very successful program, and we have been incrementally increasing the numbers, not by much, but we added some beds about 2 or 3 years ago, and the shift of the female offenders to Thistledew is going to create another 24 beds for male offenders. In fact, I think it's actually going to increase by a few more than that. It might be 15 to 20 beds, I guess it actually is going to increase the male side up at Willow River. We think that we ought to see what that does for us in terms of moving people through the system, and then talk about a next step if we still run into waiting lists. The drug offenders make up about 22% of our prison population today, and obviously that's an increase. The meth cases, you've all read the data on that. We went from about 40 up to about 500. and they get lengthy sentences. And again, you've read the comparative analysis to our surrounding states. We do have long sentences for drug offenders, and we do have a very low threshold amount of substance to get you a long sentence. So again, those are policy issues that I wish you all the luck in the world of trying to sort out. But in terms of providing that resource, I think the one thing we have to continue to do is provide those treatment beds. This isn't just MAP, it's the DUIers too. We've now got about 150 of those in the system. And they, conversely, have higher criminal scores. Our experience there has been the opposite, where very few zero or one prior felonies. Many of them have long and sophisticated criminal histories. So we would continue to work with you on that, but in terms of sorting out, should we keep more in the community, those are really issues that you need to wrestle with.
Representative Ellison, anything else?
Not at this point, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Johnson and Eastland, that's what we have so far. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Benson, I appreciate your attention to staff and public safety in your presentation. I was listening to you as you were talking about the Stillwater double bunking situation. Do you have any plans to remedy that problem? I suspect it's because it's an old facility and it doesn't really take well to double bunking, perhaps. What are your thoughts on that and plans for dealing with it?
Mr. Chair,
Deputy Commissioner Beth.
Representative Johnson, the commissioner will speak to this issue as well, but I know she's very concerned about double bunking at Stillwater and St. Cloud. The thing that I think is most important is that we go no further. First of all, we go no further than we already have in double bunking at those two facilities. You're absolutely correct. They were not designed to double bunk. They don't have the infrastructure to double bunk many more. The thing that we think will help us here and save us is the fact that at St. Cloud, 200 out of it'll be about 900 or 1,000. At Stillwater, it'll be 200, actually 400 out of 1,500 will be double bunk. They'll be moving through that very quickly. There's a fair amount of turnover in our system. So there's, if you get into a double bunk situation, hopefully within a month, 6 weeks, or 2 months, you will have earned your way back to a single room. And that philosophy or that thinking served us very well at the medium custody institutions for years when we only had 50% double bunk. They'd all go in, they'd behave themselves because they knew it was just a matter of time when they got enough seniority they'd get their single room. Now we're up to 80% and we don't have that same carrot that we used to years ago. We will, what our plans are at Stillwater and St. Cloud is to have 100 rooms at each place and stop and evaluate it, see what the number of assaults or reports or problems or issues that we have, and then either move ahead or stop there. We're not going to do anything that is going to place staff in harm's way to a greater degree than we already have. We are able to add some staff positions to both facilities, and if we have to unwind this at some point, after we get more room in our department, I'm sure that's our thinking.
And I don't need to ask for that.
Good enough. Thank you, sir.
Very good. Representative Eastland, you're last.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just spent part of the afternoon yesterday with the Commissioner and Mr. Benson, and we were at the Faribault facility. I think this is really a great proposal, I guess, particularly the Faribault, the needs. I do have one question, though, because so much of the discussion in the presentation, trying to prepare for the other position, dealt with the privatization response and comparisons. And I don't want a long answer to this because I have another question that I'd rather have you respond to. But could you just give me a yes, no, or maybe? Does privatization have a role in the prison system that we have here in Minnesota, or is it just something that we just has no role? I mean, just kind of, it does or it doesn't, or maybe in the future, or...
Mr. Chair, I think to a small degree it probably does. I think history would bear that out. When we got into trouble back in the 90s in terms of space, if you have a very, very distilled population, and you can identify who those people are, and the facility that you know where you're sending them, possibly there's a small role there as a reliever institution, so to speak. If we were put in a position where we have to use a private facility, and we may very well have to as we move toward the Faribault project, because we're going to be out of beds in our system here shortly. We're talking with our local partners. We're trying to rent county jail beds. But if we have to, the population that I think it works with, like the BOA for the females, low-level offenders who are on their way out the door, who have are in their pre-release phase of their sentence, that might make some sense. But expanding privatization beyond that, in my view, based on the reading that I've done and our own personal experience, and the precarious up and down nature of the staffing patterns at private institutions, I think it becomes risky. Many of these staff or many of these inmates, remember now, out of every four that we release, two of them we never hear from again in a three-year follow-up. So we got to be careful in terms of these offenders too. We have an obligation to move them through the system safely as well as our staff. And we can't forget these are somebody's sons and daughters, somebody's brother. They're Minnesota citizens. Many of them go out there and become very productive again. And we just have to be mindful of that as well.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the answer. And I guess my comment to that is that I mean, I'm a believer that there is a place for some but I think we have to also understand how the private sector works. The private sector is very good at filling a niche if they know the niche exists. But if the private sector is only going to be there when we need them and then they're no longer necessary, they're probably not going to be there when we need them either. So I think we should be considering the need of where this relief valve could help us, and allowing the private sector to sense that and design some kind of a response to fill that need. I think it could be helpful in our planning rather than just almost sound like it's a one or the other. I think there is a need for both. I mean, that's my personal opinion. I'm glad we share that to some degree. The other issue that I have is, there's lots of research out there in understanding how the size of populations affects the dynamic of what goes on. And I heard you say a number of times that what states are doing, Colorado and others, they're creating larger and larger communities inside of prisons. And my question is, any research been done as how that impacts inmates? We look at education, and we're finding out now that if we have elementary schools that are too big, that it really starts to have a negative impact on kids. And now we're saying they should be smaller, they should be in communities. If we're looking at rehabilitation, if we're looking at taking these people and not putting them in a school where they're going to learn more or learn how to be more criminal, have we done any research to understand the impact of this consolidation of more and more people into the same facility?
Deputy Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, let me first of all say no, I don't know that we've done any formal research, but let me give you my 30 years of experience answer to that. When we say we want to add to existing physical plants, that doesn't mean we're just going to pile them into large cell blocks. We in Minnesota have St. Cloud many years ago created a model that we refer to as controlled movement, where we move individual units independent of each other, so we don't have mass movement in any of our prisons anymore. Even our mediums, if you look at the yards you'll notice fences that fence off various living units from one another. So while we add to existing physical plants, we're also mindful of how we move those offenders and create physical barriers so that they all can't come together at one time. And I think your point is well taken, that it's important that you don't just pack them in there without corresponding program. Now, in Minnesota, as you heard me mention, we have about 14% who are unemployed or unprogrammed. Comparatively speaking, that's a phenomenal number. There are systems out there that have over 50-60% idleness in their system. And that's one of the issues that private prison industry has had. They don't create the corresponding program. To keep it cheap, to meet that per diem, they're not able to. So when you use the private facilities, you've got to be very careful to specifically spell out what you expect in terms of programming. And if it's a pre-release population, a pre-release program is not difficult to design. But again, I think if you are mindful of the size of the units at the various custody levels, at Oak Park Heights we move them in lots of 52 at a time. That's our highest custody level. At Lionel Lakes, this building that we're designing has it's actually four different wings of about 100 each. So they would live independent of one another, so there'd be 100 in each wing. So we're very mindful of how many we let come together, and then again, if you have the corresponding programming ingredient, whether it's sex offender, education, even leisure time, that's what makes it work. If you keep them busy from the day on, or the moment you unlock them in the morning until you lock them back up at 10 o'clock at night, if you have that ability, that's what keeps the inmates and the staff safe in those institutions.
One last bullet.
Sure, Representative Eastland.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the response, and I don't want to compare our prison population to our school population, but in our schools we also have classrooms of 25, and we have programming that is down into pod sizes. But we still, in that context, find that when there's less kids in the total facility, the net impact is more positive. You know, I mean, there's some optimum numbers. And I'm guessing if we're concerned about rehabilitation, if we're concerned about those things, I guess what my concern is, are we looking at all of the possible ways to create the best environment for inmates to succeed, do their time and succeed in reentry back into society, and not have the prison time be more of a school of crime? Because we hear that very, very often, that people spend their time in prison and they get out and they say they learn more about crime in prison than they did before they went in. And I guess that's my concern. I'd like to see some if somebody's done some research on that, it would be interesting to see it.
Very good. Any other questions? If not, before we depart, next week, committee, we will be taking up some individual bonding requests that will come before this committee. We'll make some kind of effort to maybe do some ranking on this committee of the various requests that we get. Ultimately, we will be working on a recommendation to pass along. No firm timetable. We have time ahead of us. Deputy Commissioner Benson, Commissioner Fabian, thank you for coming and giving this good presentation. If there have been some questions that were not answered, please try to get to those. And it's possible we would want to see you back here just to chit-chat in the next few weeks. So thanks for coming today. If there's nothing further, this meeting is at an end.